Hey there, beautiful people. Welcome to Fantai, the podcast for all those complex and complicated conversations about the gray areas in our lives. I was just arguing with myself about whether or not I was going to say complicado or complicated. And wrong in the choice. Middle of the sentence, made the decision. Also, I am here from the future past, or from the past future, Jarrett Hill.
Oh, Lord. And I am entertainment journalist, editor, authoress, Travell Anderson. What Jarrett means by that is Jarrett's currently on a little hiatus, so we are recording this episode in advance. But we also have a special little setup for you today. Mm-hmm. Something new we're trying. This won't be every episode. We will go back to our normal formats. But, you know, when we have an interview with a fave, okay, and that interview goes
a legend.
A legend, okay? When it goes over because it's just that good, sometimes we want to just give you the entire conversacion. So that's going to be the episode today. We're going to jump right into it. Our guest is Danielle Smith, author of Shine Bright, A Very Personal History of Black Women in Pop, and host of the podcast Black Girl Songbook. Hope you enjoy. Alrighty, beautiful people. So to get us into our discussion today, I want to tell you a little story. Back in 2013, the year of our Lord and Savior, Beyonce Christ, I was in a graduate journalism program at Stanford University. I've told you about that experience many times on this podcast. I want to say there was like 10 of us in the program. Only two of us were Black. We had this seminar class each quarter in which the professor, who was one of the leaders of the journalism program, would invite folks to come in, like working journalists, to come and talk about the careers and, you know, inspire us and give us the real on working in the industry. Well, there came a point in that course where I realized that not nary a person brought in to talk to us was Black. Okay. I want to say nobody was of color, but I know for sure no one else was Black. And you know me, I politely inquired to my professor as to why ain't no colored folks been brought in here. I know it's only two of us, but like, come on now. Okay. And so he basically gave me work and he said, you should find somebody to invite. Cool. And so then I was like, oh, I know this person. I don't know her, but like, I know she's down the hall because she's, you know, a Knight Fellow right now. And so for those of you who don't know, the John S. Knight Journalism Fellowship, it's a program at Stanford where they bring in dozens of veteran journalists from around the world who are looking to, you know, solve various issues and be smart for a year and solve things and all of that. And I had seen on their site that one of the fellows was this woman by the name of Danielle Smith with a Y, okay? And I immediately said to myself, that Y? That's my people. I just know that Y is my people, okay? And then upon looking at her bio, I was like, oh, not only is she my people, but she's a little bit of a legend. Like, she's a little bit of a history maker here, okay? And for those of you who don't know, right, first Black and first woman editor of Vibe magazine, I believe, first Black editor of Billboard, like, you know, knocking, like, y'all, come on now, all right? So my professor, you know, responded to my email, said, okay, invite her yourself, just do it. And so I did, and she said yes. Okay, and she was wonderful, and that started an almost now decade-long infatuation with this woman and her work and her mind. You heard her brilliance here on Fantai before when we spoke about the Grammys last year, and you can hear her every week on her podcast, Black Girl Songbook, which I have already told you numerous times that you need to be listening to over and over again. And now she's got a book out that you should have already ordered and started reading, like we told you a few weeks ago when we booked her. Okay, it's called Shine Bright, A Very Personal History of Black Women in Pop. Danielle Smith, welcome back to Fantai.
I've been missing y'all so deeply, honestly. Like, I've been wondering, like, is so many like nice things happening in my life? I was like, but what's that one thing that's just missing? What's missing? And it's y'all. Let me just admit, it's y'all. How are you doing?
We're doing amazing.
Oh, good.
We're doing really well and so grateful to have you here. Travell like flew through your book and was like, so just to be clear, this is a Danielle Smith Stan account and period. That's what this is going to be.
Period.
I have just been diving into the book and like realizing so much that I've learned about you just like so quickly, right? Like, I did not realize that we're both from the Bay Area. I was born at Kaiser Oakland. And
Providence Hospital, Oakland. It's not even called that. I think it's called Alta Bates now, but yeah.
Yeah, Alta Bates is where my brother was born.
Okay.
I have so much family in Oakland, and I grew up in Richmond. And like, I was just like reading your story. I was like, oh my gosh, this is why she feels so familiar whenever I talk to her.
Oh, yes.
But I wanted to know, I was watching you as Travelle was telling their story of finding you and meeting you and loving you. And I was watching your face, and I've been curious about what it's been like to have spent so much time writing this book and now to be out talking about your own personal story, but then also like getting flowers from folks for the work that you've been doing. What has that felt like for you over the process of this press tour?
I mean, the simple, straightforward answer is that it feels fantastic. It feels surreal, honestly, to have written this thing that's taken me over 5 years. So I was working on it when we were at Stanford, Spell, so it goes back that far. I should say I was struggling writing it when we was at Stanford, but yes. and then it is wonderful. And, you know, I have friends, good friends that tell me all the time, you know, you're going to take this love, Danielle. You're going to accept these flowers. You're going to take this love because it isn't easy for me. If you have read Shine Bright, I don't think it's a spoiler to say that as I'm interweaving my story in with the stories of these great and famous women of Black women in pop music, my story, like so many of their stories, is traumatic, especially in childhood and in the teen years. And so when you have a history of loved ones, you know, telling you that you aren't going to make it or that your creativity isn't real or that you're not as smart as you actually think you are, you're not as pretty as you think you are, you're not a lovely speaker, you're actually a noisy little chatty Cathy. Mm-hmm. So when you grow up hearing these things, it is difficult to take that love and accept those flowers. But you know, a sister has been in therapy for a good long while now. And so we are turning corners over here. We are turning corners.
I love it. I love it. Okay, so I want to give the people, I want to let y'all know, Danielle has done a lot of press, okay? She been everywhere for this book, okay? So if you want some of them, you know, the basic type questions that you might typically hear, go watch those, go engage with those, okay? Because, you know, I have my questions, Danielle, I'm letting you know now. They're specific. I'm diving deep. I was taking notes as I was listening, okay? But I would love to start and ask you about how this, there's a line that you say often in like every episode of Black Girl Songbook, right? And it's about this idea of giving Black women in pop the credit that y'all are due. Talk to us a bit mm-hmm. about how that has come to be your life work.
I mean, some of it I could just say, you know, I just woke up and was tired, like tired enough to really, really and truly get to work on the thing that I had been kind of sideways, halfways working on my entire career. And in some ways, I could say, since I went to go see the Jackson 5 and Janet Jackson at the Circle Star Theater in San Carlos, California for my 8th birthday, like it, I think that really was the moment of destiny, mm-hmm. honestly. I don't think that there's been a lot of plan to my career. I think that there's been a lot of ambition, there's been a lot of hustle, there's been a lot of creativity, there's been a lot of rigorous reporting, there's been a lot of leadership, but a lot of planning, that would be absolutely not. So what I began to see, especially during that time at Stanford, I'm so happy that you brought it up, and I tell anybody, whatever field you're in, there's a fellowship or there's a something. Mm-hmm. Apply. Apply twice. Apply again if you don't get in. Because as my godfather told me when I told him I was going to Stanford for a year, he said, oh, I see you doing what the white folks do to say to stay sane. Mm. And he was in corporate America for 40 years before he retired at a high level. So at Stanford, I had the opportunity to think. I had the opportunity to know that what I was writing wasn't really what I should be writing because I had a book deal to write something like Shine Bright when I was at Stanford. Mm. But even as I was doing all these other things at Stanford, going to the design school, taking classes at the business school, running around with journalists like Treville, like my friends in Afghanistan now, like they just really, you know, my friends in Spain, my friends in, you know, the South, everywhere, like just learning about myself and also getting reminders from my peers about who I am. It was such an emotional year for me, but I came out of it doing a project that I had said I was going to do for Stanford, a wonderful project called Hardcover. But what was underneath all that hardcover energy was me knowing that I had to write a book about Black women in pop. And then about halfway through that, after some hills and valleys and dramas and traumas, I'm back with One World. I'm back with the genius that is Chris Jackson over there at One World, who also edits Ta-Nehisi and Nicole Hannah and everybody. And Chris was like, you're going to have to put yourself in this book in order to finish it, in order to truly give the Black women that you want to give credit to, you're going to have to actually be strong and pick your favorites and stop being wishy-washy, Miss Danielle. And then the next thing you know, I have a partner that allows me some flexibility because of his constant support, but I was able to resign from ESPN and spend full time getting this book done. Because see, once I knew that I was in the business of giving Black women the credit that they were due, once I knew I was in the business of adding myself into the story, well, see, then now I'm not struggling. I'm not saying it wasn't hard or that I didn't have difficulties or there wasn't a lot of work, but I knew I could see that, like I said, from that moment with Janet Jackson and the Jacksons, and when I was 8 years old, you know, you don't know how you're going to get there, but you see that the ending is in front of you. You know, that North Star had been pointed out to me, and I was on my way.
I want to kind of stay here a little bit more about, like, the women and the personal connection to it, because Treville and I are in, like, the final stage of writing this first draft of this book, right? Woo! And turning it in, God. I'm like, Black Jesus, get us across the finish line.
Okay,
Lord,
wait,
come
pause,
on.
Pause. What is the book? I feel like I know, but I don't know.
Yeah, so we are finishing up our final part of the first draft of Historically Black Phrases, where we're taking all of the things that have been a part of Black language and Black, you know, culture, and the things that we say, and putting them into like a coffee table book that will be beautiful and like it's reported and all kinds of things like that. So,
oh my God! So you guys are in the business of giving Black people the credit that they're due, is what you're saying?
Big period.
Well, that's why I was connecting to you here, because we've been talking, and as I'm writing this stuff down and like thinking about how I want to put it together, I've been thinking so much about how important it is that we document our history, because there are so few places that we can really like record these things, right? And like, and make sure that they are written into history. And so as I'm reading this book, I'm thinking about the importance of what we're doing, but the importance of what you've just done, and giving life to these stories that don't really get unpacked in the ways that they should, right? And so I just wanted you to talk more about the importance of us doing this right now and how we can write them into history to make sure that they're not forgotten.
I'm so happy to hear about this book. Not just because the book is about to be put on whatever Amazon wish list or whatever is available to me right now to love and support. Not just for that reason, but because I know how you guys roll. And I know that you guys are having fun and games and talk and chat and all of that is going on Fanti. But I know you all, for the writers and the reporters and the researchers that you all are. And I know that, and I know how passionate you guys are. And I think that is the magic intersection with regard to how we have to continue to tell our stories and to advocate for the histories that have been swept under the rug. You can say a lot of things about that movie, Hidden Figures, but let me tell you something. I loved it. Same. I loved it.
Yes.
I am the Hidden Figures t-shirt wearer. I want the souvenir pencil and tote bag. Like, I want everything. Because what I loved about it was the fact that so often, in my case, and it's women, Black women in music, in your case, it's going to be our vocabulary, okay, a history of our language. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our sentences, our paragraphs, all of that. It's like these things get written about in summary. These things get written about like saying, oh, well, we were the first people to say that and we want our credit for that. But, you know, in 2022, that's not enough for me. Mm-hmm. I need the details. Mm-hmm. I heard you say it's reported out. I need to know, like in the chapter in the Dixie Cups in Shine Bright, the chapter was originally called The Girls in the Green Dresses, because I feel like, why do I know everything about the hair mousse that Bob Dylan and the Beatles put in their hair with the floppy bangs? And I know everything about what kind of shoes Jimi Hendrix wore and what kind of leather pants Bruce Springsteen, but I don't know that the people that bumped the Beatles off the number one slot wore green dresses to every audition that they auditioned in, and that their grandmother inspired them by taking them through department stores that weren't even open to Black people in those days, because all that comes out in their music. Mm-hmm. So I know that when you guys report and say, oh, we were the first people to say, I don't know, give me them girls in Daisy Dukes. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't even know if that's in there, but it's just one of my favorite songs. And so my thing is, I know I'm not going to get, they were the first artists from Florida to really do blankety blank, and we love them for that reason. There's a space for that, but I know that that's not where y'all are at. And I think that's important that we bring that passion and that rigor to these spaces. Not in summary. I don't want to know what a whole bunch of Black girls did on a Thursday anymore. Mm-hmm. I want to know specifically what Pamela, Angela, and Renee have been doing. Mm-hmm. That's what I want to know. And I know that's what you guys are going to bring to this thing about language. We could change the whole topic, honestly, right now, because I want to be in the business. I'm nosy.
All right, hold on right there. Okay, take a little pause. We're going to take a quick break. Y'all know what it is. We're going to take a quick break, okay? Go get you a snack or something. We're going to pay some bills. We'll be right back.
So for my friend, I had a friend that was here visiting from out of state where the weed isn't legal. And I asked them if they wanted an edible and they were so excited. And so I was like, calm down. I'll get you one. And like, I had my Lumi Labs like microdose, like the gummies. And they're so good that I'm always like, don't eat too many of them, because you'll start taking them to the head and then the head will come back. But for people who love weed or like are interested in trying weed or have never really gotten into it but are interested in maybe microdosing is something that people are talking about. And if you search around a bit on the internet, you'll find all sorts of people are microdosing to feel healthier and perform better. Our show today is sponsored by Microdose Gummies. Microdose Gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good. As I said, I have been a fan of these gummies, one, because they taste good, but two, because they're effective. And marijuana has been something that has, I know it's very controversial for a lot of folks, but for me, it's been incredibly helpful as a creative to be able to help me with focusing for writing and developing and ideating and brainstorming and all of those different things. It helps lots of different people in all kinds of different ways with just enjoying the moment, sometimes with pain and sleep and anxiety and even recovery from working out. So microdosing is available nationwide. To learn more about microdosing THC, just do a quick search online or go to microdose.com and use code FANTI to get free shipping and 30% off your first order. Links can be found in the show description. But again, that's microdose.com. Use the code FANTI.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about, like I said, I've been doing the audiobook. Which the listeners know I've had a journey with audiobooks on this podcast. Because, you know, I like the paper, okay?
I'm so proud of you, friend.
Yeah, well, so what I do, I buy the book and I buy the audiobook so that I can do both, okay? So, because I like the hard copy, okay? Anyway, but one of the things I love also is that, like, I knew that you had read your audiobook, right? And so we would hear how so you important. Read things and what where the feeling and emotion, you know, comes up for you. And as I was listening to the book, this was the day that I called Jared and said, this is a Danielle Smith Stan account. I was listening to the book and you were getting emotional talking about Jody Watley's Grammy speech for Best New Artist. And it gave me a flashback, Danielle, back to Stanford.
I know where you're going.
Your presentation at the end of the program about Hardcover. And I was in the audience. I was editor-in-chief of this, like, tech media blog thing. And I was covering the presentations and doing my little rankings or whatnot. And that was the first time that I saw, like, how passionate, like, you are about the work that you do. And also hearing it as you read your book in these various different moments. I've always said to myself that, like, if the work that I'm doing isn't making me, like, as passionate, as emotional, as angry at times as Danielle when it comes to the work that she does, then I need to find something else to do. Talk to me a little bit about that emotion, that core, that passion.
You know, I was so embarrassed that day.
Really?
At Stanford. My God. I was so embarrassed, and not for my feelings and not for my commitment to my project. And at that time, I was very much talking about creating journalistic spaces, you know, for serving underserved, you know, marginalized communities, mm-hmm. which matters deeply to me, deeply still. I went right back into therapy after that. I wanted to be able to be passionate and not feel, though, out of control. That was a pain point for me about that very specific presentation. And it's something that I often bring up and even want to just to talk about my journey. And when I speak to my husband about it, who you know, Elliot Wilson, and we talk about that moment, I always say, it's not that many. Travell's a witness to that moment when I changed my mind about wanting to be able to speak with passion, but be in control. And that's literally what I went to my therapist with. I believe in therapy, but I believe in a goal. Mm-hmm. I don't believe in just going up in there and talking about shit to the chat. Okay, I don't. I'm like, the three things I'm trying to get out of this over the next year is this, this, and this, boo. So how can we move in those directions? And so that was one of them. And it's worked for me. The tools that I have a great therapist that she's given me about breathing mm-hmm. and pausing and also just owning the emotion and allowing other people. She says so much of being out of control and not being able to say control tears and things like that is not believing that the people that you're speaking to are with you. Mm. And that's a matter of confidence. And so those are the kinds of things that I had to work on because I never want to lose that. I don't want to put pancake over that. Okay. Mm-hmm. I want that rawness to be out there because, as you said, what are we doing here? Why are we doing this work? If we're just always just about the inverted pyramid or whatever of the fire that happened mm-hmm. on the corner of Fifth and Main. That is not the reason that I got into journalism. It's not the reason I try to work and refine and make my work as good as I believe that it is. So, no, I don't want to lose it. I'm not always comfortable talking about it. But the thing is, I'm not giving in to that anymore. Mm-hmm. But I'm also not giving in to, I'm going to literally weep and not being able to control, because what that says to myself, and I think even sometimes to the audience, is that she's not dealing with it. Mm. And I need my message to be, because it is true, that I'm dealing with it. Like, I'm dealing with these stories of Black women that need to be told. It's criminal to me. the way their accomplishments go unacknowledged. It's just, it's to the point, and I use the word, it's evil. Mm-hmm. It's strategic. And so I'm upset. That doesn't take away from the kind of reporting that I do or the amount of care I put into every sentence that I write. And I don't like that we have been trained, and you all know this, in journalism school or in English class in high school. You know, you have to take the emotion out of it and just be objective. Mm-hmm. Just say what happened. Well, no, I don't want to just say what happened. I want us to get the background to what happened. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to talk to the same folks that you always talk to as sources. As Travelle said at the top of this, where's the black people speaking to the class? And so I want to say that with passion and data. I want when I was at ESPN, we had a department called stats and information. So I'm coming with the passion and the stats and the information.
Period.
I hope that answers.
It
yes.
definitely did. Ugh.
I want to kind of hang adjacent to there, because one of the things you talk about in the book, and we talk about this in class at USC, our first week, we talked about ethics, right? Mm-hmm. I'm doing a reporting entertainment and pop culture class, and like, I'm like, oh, I need to have Danielle come speak next semester to the class too, right? But like, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about how these stories often don't get told, and you and your book talk about the ethical fight that you have with yourself about developing relationships with the people that you're covering. Mm-hmm. And as I hear you talking about how hard it's been to try to remove yourself from it, I would imagine that you've had conversations with some of the black women that you've covered over mm-hmm. the years about what it feels like to not get covered, right? To not, you have like these wonderful stories of your interviews with Janet Jackson and how she will say something, but she won't say something, or she'll put words back in your mouth and say, I didn't say that. And you're like, well, girl, I didn't say that either. Right. And so, I love those stories. And I'm curious about what they've said to you about what it feels like to not be able to get the coverage or not to be able to have their stories told and heard. What have those conversations that you've had with these women been like?
They've told me many different things, but the through line is that they're brokenhearted and they're angry. I mean, that's the through line. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. And I wish, you know, I could say that I was the only person that had been spoken to about these things. But black women over the last 100 years have been very outspoken about it. I mean, we can go all the way to Lena Horne just never really being written about as a woman. That's the reason she did her one-woman show. That was her version of a memoir. That was her version of a type of a journalism about herself, because she was so tired of being misrepresented or not represented. I was around when Destiny's Child was Destiny's Child, and when Beyoncé was about to go solo. She may have said this to me, but I know she's said it to many people, that she was told by her publicist that, no, that there was no hope for her to be on the cover of a Vogue or an Elle or a Harper's Bazaar or any of these types of very mainstream fashion and culture magazines. And why? Well, they just don't. I mean, it's just not. Oh, it's because I'm black. Mm-hmm. See, and it's super easy to forget that was the case just 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I'm also a little bit cynical about the reason that it changed. I mean, one of the reasons it changed is because the magazine business was tanking. Mm-hmm. And so as ever, when things get rough, you reach out to the black people.
All right.
Because you know that that audience is underserved. So you know that when we see a Lupita, when we see a Beyonce, on the cover of these magazines, it's like, oh, you know how we love a good first. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, is Beyonce on, is Cardi B on the cover of, is Oprah? Okay, so I'm buying 3 copies because I need one, my mom need one, my aunt need one, and I actually need 2. So.
One to read and one to put away.
Yeah, and like in a Ziploc bag somewhere for my grandchildren. Right, right. So I really am, like, they say it to, I feel like they say it all the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a journalist, I've been requested a lot of times to speak to Black women about their stories, even when they know that they don't always agree with what I say. They know that I'm going to at least be paying attention to the details of their lives. Mm-hmm. I've definitely been in situations where subjects have been displeased with something that I placed in a piece because of context or because it's true or and it's not easy to maintain relationships over the years. It's very tough on us, I still believe, to read stories about ourselves by other people, even if the authors are Black or of color or from marginalized spaces, because it's still, even in 2022, it's still very, very new to have, to sit for a Black person to sit down with anybody and talk to them and then have that information reported on and written down and storified and created by someone else and given back to them, and then you read it and you didn't really have control and things like that. I think it's very, very, very difficult still. I think we forget how rare it is still. I mean, my husband just had a cover story, GQ cover story, about Future on the cover of GQ. I sit and I think, that is so wonderful. I'm so proud of him. Then I ask myself, how many Black men in the history of Condé Nast have had that space? Even with you all's project, which you see now I'm deeply infatuated by, I feel like I can go into a bookstore. I am a sucker for, is there a book about quotes? Because I want it. Is there a book about, is there a new thesaurus done some type of different way than Roger? I need that for my library. I haven't seen your book at the store. I have not seen it at the library. And when you think about what year we're in, and I haven't seen it, listen. This is all still very new. It was new when Ebony was doing it. It was new when Vibe and Latina were doing it and Essences was doing it. It's still new now, and it's unfortunate.
Oh, my God. That also reminds me about how so much about your book, for me, is also like a media history, right? Like hearing you tell the story of being at Vibe and like needing the Whitney Houston cover to hit in a particular way to, like, I don't want to say keep the lights on, but like you needed it to, but you needed it to hit.
But Loki,
you needed it High to key. Hit. Okay. High key. All right. Or High like key. There's another one where you have, it was a Wyclef Jean cover and you're like, it's not going to hit. I need to pivot and make another decision. And that decision was the Lauryn Hill cover, right? That we all know, but, right?
Yes.
But also the Kirk Franklin cover, your first cover everything. There, right? Like,
yes. Everything. Yes. So I wanted to ask about just like I feel like those histories of Black media, we don't know. Mm. We don't hear. Mm-mm. Like, we don't, and I don't know what it is, but side note, this reminds me also of Kierna Mayo's podcast, Culture Conversations. She did a two-parter episode about Honey Magazine and the experience of that. So check that out. But we don't hear these stories, and it I don't know. I feel like, especially when we see the quote unquote state of Black media right now, like, I don't know what the question is, but I'm just,
we don't see it.
We just don't see it. We don't see it. I wanted to hear just you talk about like the role of Black media in particular in this journey as we're talking about Black women in pop music.
It's never enough. It's just never enough. Like, there's just, there's just never enough of it quantity wise, and there's never enough money. Let me just speak particularly about Black media. There's never enough money in Black media to do the type of reporting that can and should be done. There just isn't. It's not applied to us. I've worked everywhere. I know how much money it costs to send somebody to Mississippi. To remember the Dancing Dolls, that show.
Come on, DD4L. So,
there we go. So when I first got to ESPN, I sent Karen, Renee Good down there. Karen and I have been working together. Karen used to work at Vibe too. It's a quietly, we getting older, but it's a quiet Vibe mafia out there still doing good work. And I knew Karen would understand that because Karen's a dancer in addition to being a writer and a poet and a mom and all the many wife and the many things that she is. But, you know, when you work for ESPN and you finally can get a, you finally sell a story, I got a pitch to somebody else to get the money to do, tell them how much it will cost. They tell me it should cost less, this, that, and the third. But, you know, it's a lot of money to send a woman from, I think she was living in Brooklyn at that time, down to, I guess it was Mississippi. And then also you got to send a photographer. You got to send a videographer. You also got to pay me. You got to pay the copy editor. You got to pay the fact checker, because I believe in all of that. Mm-hmm. Shine Bright itself is fact check, bottom to top. Shout out to Sabrina Ford. And it's like, I used to feel this way at Vibe too. We actually have money to do this. Who else has money to do this? Mm-hmm. To pay a person their rate? I mean, I hate to remind people because it sounds so wild. I was paying people a dollar a word when I was at Vibe, $1.50 a word if they were an author. You know what this allows that person to do? Breathe for a minute.
Yeah.
It allows that person to say, well, I know that check, well, this is a 5,000 word piece that Danielle signed me. So that's 10 grand I have coming within, let's say, because we was probably net 120, but don't hate. Let's say net 90.
Not net 120.
Yeah, listen, we were doing our best. I'm exaggerating.
Let's make sure for people who don't know what that means. Net 120 means you can pay them within 120 days.
Let me not throw my managing editors and all my people on the business side of it under the bus. I would say we were like net 60, but you at least knew, right? If this is February, at the end of March, I'm going to have 10 grand. So what that allows me to do is say, okay, so I know my rent's paid. I have my groceries. If I have to come a little bit out of my savings right here, I know I can put it right back in. Also, they're paying my expenses. If I have to call long distance to do some reporting, or God forbid, take a train or a cab somewhere to do some reporting and pay for that, pay for the photographs to be retouched, maybe get a little illustration done. This is money. Do you know how few publications in the history of Black media have had that kind of luxury? It's just not that many. And really, it's the music ones, really. And Ebony paid so much attention to music. You know, Ebony was a culture magazine at the end of the day. But where is that now? It is the beyond heartbreaking to me. That was one of the reasons we raised so much money for the publication, the one-time publication of hardcover. It's because we wanted to pay everybody. I didn't want people to volunteer to make journalism. So it's just, I pray, I know Corey Murray, a recent executive editor of Essence, I pray that Corey is somewhere on a beach, number one, but I pray that she's writing about her many, almost two decades, I believe.
Yeah.
At the highest levels of Essence Magazine and Festival, okay, which is its own kind of journalism also. It's curation of the highest order. I know Jamel is working on something. I need to know Jamel's story for real, for real, about, you know, everything. This is two people that I'm thinking of. I need my husband to get busy. I need all, like, I need y'all to, y'all are doing what y'all are doing, but then I'm going to need you guys to write down who you are and what you do mm-hmm. and what your journeys have been like, because mm-hmm. especially I'm looking at you, Travell. We've been doing things, and I need to know the ins and the outs and the ups and the downs.
I got something coming. I got something coming. Stay tuned.
Okay. Stay tuned. Okay. I need to know. I need to know.
Okay, Danielle, I think this is a great place for us to take just a little bit of a break, because I want to ask you something about what you were just saying. So let's take a quick break. When we come back, we've got more of our conversation with Danielle Smith, talking about her brand new book, Shine Bright. Fansite's coming right back.
Video games.
Video games.
Video games. You like them?
Maybe you wish you had more time for them?
Maybe you want to know the best ones to play?
Maybe you want to know what happens to Mario when he dies?
In that case, you should check out Triple Click. It's a podcast about video games.
A podcast about video games? But I don't have time for that.
Sure you do. Once a week, kick back as three video game experts give you everything from critical takes on the hottest new releases,
to scoops, interviews, and explanations about how video games work,
to fascinating and sometimes weird stories about the games we love.
Triple Click is hosted by me, Kirk Hamilton.
Me, Jason Schreier.
And me, Maddie Myers.
You can find Triple Click wherever you get your podcasts and listen at MaximumFun.org.
Bye.
You're in a theater. The lights go down. You're about to get swept up by the characters and all their little details and interpersonal dramas. You look at them and think, that person is so obviously in love with their best friend. Wait, am I in love with my best friend? That character's mom is so overbearing. Why doesn't she just stand up to her? Oh God, do I need to stand up to my own mother? If you've ever recognized yourself in a movie, then join me, Jordan Cruciola, for the podcast Feeling Seen. We've talked to author Susan Orlean on realizing her own marriage was falling apart after watching Adaptation, an adaptation of her own work, and comedian Hari Kondabolu on why Harold and Kumar was a depressingly important movie for Southeast Asians. So join me every Thursday for the Feeling Seen podcast here on Maximum Fun.
I want to stay in that thread about the work that we do, and I was at a dinner party recently, and like a friend of mine said to me, like, you live a pretty fabulous life. And like, I didn't hear the rest of the sentence that she said. Right. And I was like, what? And I started thinking about the work that we get to do. Mm-hmm. Right. And like, as you talk about the $10,000, I think someone hears that and they think like, well, I wish I was getting $10,000 a piece. Right. And it's like, but everybody doesn't know, like, how much time there is between those two, the next piece, right?
Oh, yeah.
Or how hard it was to get that piece, or how much time it took to write it. And I love that you talk about what it does for the writer or the creative or the artist or whomever to be able to do that, to then have to turn something else out, right? And as we've been doing this book, it's been great to get an influx of money. Mm-hmm. And like, I haven't had to work as hard because I was working hard, right? Because I'm working hard in this way. I would love for you to talk a little bit more, because in the book you said, I don't think I've paid for music since I was 25. And I remember thinking, like, I've been going to shows lately and going to things lately, and if I can't get the seat that I want or the press pass that I'm not really that interested in being at your show. I would love for you to talk about just some of the greatest moments that you've had, because you talk about a lot of fantastic things that you've gotten to do in this book. But I want to talk about how cool it is to get to be a journalist. As I think about the students that I have going out into the world that are getting ready to maybe become full-time journalists or dabble in journalism or know that it's not for them, how cool has it been to be a journalist amongst a community of other Black journalists?
I'm still having a really good time. to be clear. I'm always having a better time. I love being an editor and a leader in the space, but I am actually always having a better time being a writer. That's without question.
Well, because, and the reason I think about this is because you say like, have I toasted with Mariah? have I ridden in a vintage convertible with Queen Latifah? You know what I mean? Like, you're telling us, like I've done some cool shit. And I want people to know that.
I mean, the thing is, you know, we all have what's called, I think, shorthand for it is our heyday, mm-hmm. right? That moment, I think that starts like when you're not coming of age, but you've come of age. And if you're a creative, you're really into, like, you know, kind of know what you want to do, and you're working with and around the people that you want to work with, and the scenes that you're a part of. For me, it was the hip hop scene and the music scene. I'm blessed to have come up in the 90s to be a leader in the culture space, in the music space in the 90s. It's a blessing. But if you speak to Cynthia Horner, who ran Right On magazine, who I would not be here without seeing Cynthia's face in the front of Right On magazine as a child, Cynthia's gonna tell me that my 90s is really whack compared to her 80s and 70s. So I have done many a cool thing. I'm blessed to, when I think of you, say, what are some of the cooler things that I've done? Man, listen, I was in Paris for N-Words in Paris.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Two nights. It was so sweaty. They don't even call it the Bercy Auditorium anymore. But whatever, it was the Bercy back then, B-E-R-C-Y. And it was the Watch the Throne tour. And you know I'm backstage.
You know I'm backstage.
Right? Period.
That's my point.
Period.
That is my point. You know I'm backstage.
Listen, I worked for this, man.
And you look, did.
That's what I'm saying. I wasn't, and the kids should know, I wasn't backstage when I was 24 going to see Gangstar at the DNA Lounge in San Francisco. No, I was not. I was showing a fake-ass San Francisco Bay Guardian business card, begging to get in. And as a woman, you know, it was roughity, rough. And I'm that girl with boobs and lips. And let me tell you something. Some nights it works for you, and some nights it works against you. So I feel like, listen, I have gone from those types of nights to, yes, backstage in Paris with Jay-Z and company, feeling like, and Spike Lee was with us, Gwyneth Paltrow, like all of us just walking up to the stage with him. It's moments like that I will never forget. Interview and talk about that moment with Queen Latifah. I know Dana from when she was on tour with Digital Underground, Public Enemy, Big Daddy Kane, Heavy D and the Boys. I know her from, because I had a boyfriend on that tour. And so I used to go out on the tour often. So I got to know her that way. So when I pitched her for a story, she was kind of like, hold up. Is this, everybody in California calls me Danny. So is this Danny Smith? I was like, as a matter of fact, it is, Queen. She said, well, if it's really Danny Smith, then this is really Dana. And I'll just, if we're trying to get this done, I'll just come scoop you up. And I'm like, you're in Manhattan? She was like, girl, I'm in Harlem. She came and picked me right up. We went and drove all around Manhattan with the top down, just having the best of time. Like, in these ways, I am blessed. And I feel like it's one of the things that they said to me when I was writing Shine Bright. And Chris was like, you have to put yourself in the book. And I was like, I don't know. I just feel like I've been telling these stories at the bar my whole career. And he was like, these stories at the bar that you've been telling, I'm gonna need you to round those up and type them out and do some research and add to them and give them the context that they deserve. Like that piece I had, the chapter on Whitney Houston, and sitting there with Eddie LaVert and Gerald LaVert, God rest his soul, Whitney Houston, God rest her soul, and seeing Whitney and Bobby walk in like that night. This is a story that I've told so many times, but never do I tell it, of course, at the bar with the kind of detail that I give to it in Shine Bright. But that night, man, that's not a great night, right? It's not a night I remember with joy like I do, you know, with Latifah or any of the great shows that I've been to. But I'm happy that I at least saw it, because I really don't think, y'all, that I ever wanted to believe that Whitney was really getting that high. But then I saw it for myself, and I saw everybody else see it. I saw that some looked shocked as I did. I saw some looked like, I've seen this before. See, because I'm a journalist, I'm not just there. I think I was drinking vodka back then, sipping on my vodka tonic. I'm not just there sipping on my vodka gimlet is what I really think it was. I'm also watching. Mm-hmm. I'm also writing things down. I'm committing things to memory. I was good for writing on a napkin, and I never do I not have a pen. This was in the pre-cell phone era, so I didn't even, we weren't even having like a notes app or anything. But I was looking at Eddie LaVert and just watching his mind turn over, and you could see him asking himself, I am going to handle this. I'm just trying to put a strategy together. What is my strategy? Because we all just sitting at the table brokenhearted. It's Whitney Houston. Like, it's Whitney Houston. And she was outside of herself. Mm. And I say again, it wasn't a great night, but for what I do, to have been an eyewitness, it makes all the difference in the world. Because I'm not guessing. I'm not telling secondhand anymore. And it was a problem that I always had. Even with that, do you smoke crack? All that on TV. Mm-hmm. The disrespect, the lack of empathy, the in business that you don't even know the flavor of the Kool-Aid, Miss Ma'am. Mm-hmm. Did you ask her anything about like where she was in her spirit or in her mental state, or how must it feel to be you, Whitney Houston, and having to, as George Benson says, you know, live in this masquerade for us to enjoy and party to and fall in love to and break up to and all of these things that you're responsible to the world for, and you just want to jump in her face and ask her about her drug use like that when white culture, mainstream culture, has lifted up drug addiction as romantic and creative. I think about this all the time. When it's Sid and Nancy, it's okay, right? Mm. When it's Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, it's their legends. But when it's Whitney Houston and Bobby Brown, let's round up everybody and put them in jail and embarrass them to the nth degree on national television. But I digress.
I specifically, in the last year and a half, I've been thinking a lot about how the press and media, how the ways that we have these narratives in media, how they shape the stories themselves and how they impact the people that we're covering. And the thing that started that was actually the Britney Spears documentary from the New York Times, where they were going into her conservatorship. And then they did one on Janet Jackson, right? What they called Malfunction, the dressing down of Janet Jackson. It's on Hulu. And I think for most Black, well, for a lot of Black folks, the interesting story of Janet Jackson and the Nipplegate situation was that it was always Nipplegate. It was always about Janet Jackson, and it was never about Justin Timberlake, who did the thing, right? And how the media, like, swarmed on that story and created it to be even bigger, right? And I started thinking about that after seeing Britney Spears. But when I hear you talking about Whitney Houston and Janet Jackson, but even you go all the way back, right? I can't think of her last name, Phyllis
Wheatley.
Phyllis Wheatley at the beginning of your book. And I think about how, like, these people's stories not getting told or getting told in the way that they are, how they impact the story themselves.
Yes.
And as you're talking about Whitney, I'm thinking about how many documentaries we've seen and how many narratives we've seen about her. But, like, I still feel like we've not seen how, like, the world has shaped Whitney, if that makes sense. And like, the media around her. And I'm curious how you think about the ways that media and our jobs, and to some degree, and like, social media and all that kind of stuff, how they shape artists and narratives and stories in ways that can be healthy but also unhealthy.
I mean, short answer is, I don't know how we can even pretend to live in a world where fans, the masses, aren't doing the majority of the shaping of the narratives around life in general, let alone Black women's lives. So I don't know if there's a thing to be done about it. I don't know that I dislike it 100% either. I was being interviewed for a documentary that I don't even think ever came out, and it was about Michael Jackson. My fanship for Michael Jackson, especially as a child and a teenager, is historic. And they said, well, isn't it awful now the way things are with the internet, where you can just put Michael Jackson's name in? And this was prior to the charges and things of that nature. That you could just put his name in and like 8 billion things come up about him. You don't know what's true, what's not true. You don't know if the stats are correct. You don't know, you know, if the information about his family is correct. You don't know if the photo is real. You don't know any of these things. Isn't it terrible? I said, absolutely not. I said, I grew up thirsty. I said, I grew up 100% thirsty for anything that looked like Michael Jackson or the Jackson family. I couldn't find anything. Barely anything for the amount of records even that they were selling as a group, the amount of impact that they were having on culture, to try to find just stories about them. And here's the thing, I've done the research. We can all go back and look at the magazines. You will find way more work done around the lives of other groups that did not sell as many records or have as much impact on culture as Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5, than Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5. So as I told that man, who was British, white, I'm kind of excited that I could just write a name in and everything come up. This is why we over-index in social, because we curious. We have things that we want to know and we have things that we want to say. So I don't, as much as social is awful in so many ways, I still like the access to information. How would I know right now what it was like for Ella Fitzgerald to get interviewed by the Canadian broadcasting host that I quote in Shine Bright, and the crazy way that man spoke to her and just dehumanized her emotions? Just how would I know that if it wasn't for the internet? Because it's not in any of the many biographies of Ella Fitzgerald that exist, because we didn't have the internet before. And also because so many of Ella Fitzgerald's, like so many jazz greats, their biographies are written by people that aren't as interested in the artist's humanity, let alone their blackness. So yeah, I just wouldn't know. So I can't just hate on the internet and YouTube and all these things that are causing us so much pain right now. I want us to figure out a way to get them better regulated and things like that, but no, it's the library come to life for me. I'm sorry, like I can't do it. I can't do it. As a journalist, it's hard. I gotta be able to find things out. I got to.
Someone just said to us in one of our interviews that social media and the internet has given us back a little bit more control of our narrative, right? When we only had 3 TV shows at one time, or we only had the WB, or we only had Fox on Thursday, or whatever it was, like, that the internet and social media, while it has, you know, many things that we can be upset about or frustrated about or fight about, that it has given us the opportunity to be able to have a little bit more control over our narratives. And as we're thinking about historically black phrases, like the ways that we can put things out into the world without having to have the white man's approval, right? That runs the network, or that runs the label, or that runs the whatever. And I thought that was really profound, and it you just brought that back up for me. So, Travelle, I know you have one more question.
I just have one quick question. It's a writing question. I like asking writers writing questions. And one of the things...
How did you do it, girl? No, sorry.
Y'all are a mess.
We just stopped texting. We should give the money back. We just stopped that this week. So...
But I want to ask particularly... one of the things that resonates with me about, like, your general writing style is you do a lot of what people might call run-on sentences. And I do them a lot because I'm trying to put some things together, and I need you to see how I'm putting these things together. But I know that, like, you know, my editors be, you know, they be fighting against me from time to time because they like, you do it a lot. But I wanted, that's something that, like, I think you use beautifully in the book to paint these, like, fuller pictures of a person, of a happening, of a circumstance. Like, we not only know what the person was wearing, but we also know, like, what the weather was like, right? Or why their hair was the way their hair was, or what was happening in the White House at the time, or whatever the case may be. You add all of these details so beautifully. I just wanted to ask about how you came to, like, be to that type of approach in your writing.
I probably have always been writing like that. I'm a person that has kept journals for as long as probably I could write, you know, back when you had those journals with the little fake gold lock on the outside. And when you're writing in your journal, you don't have an editor. You know what I mean? So you're just writing, you know, la, 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 la. And I even remember back then being very committed to recording what the weather was like on a given day. Or what songs were I heard the most on the radio on a given day. Those kinds of things have always seemed connected to me. Just, I think that part of it is just in my DNA. And then I remember, you know, by the time I got to high school and was taking creative writing classes and stuff, I was blessed to have great teachers in high school. Mrs. Lutgen and Mrs. Walsh, who I still speak to on the Facebook, you know, teachers always say, well, you know, you need to learn the rules before you can break them. Mm-hmm. Mm. So I was like, okay, well, I'll learn the rules. Where's that class? Okay. So then you learn the rules, and I still was writing the run-on sentences. And I was still getting marks against for that reason. So I'm like, okay, so you told me to learn the rules. I know what the rules are. I know the difference in types of sentences. I know what a run-on sentence is. Why am I still getting marks back? And so, well, you need to be able to state your intention with these run-on sentences. I was like, okay, move the goalposts. I'm cool. What does that mean, though? To say why you're doing it. Why is it important to you to do it here? And to also be more intentional about how you use them and to use them strategically. Like, if you have a whole paragraph or a whole page full of run-on sentences, then now it's just ridiculous. Ain't nobody reading all that. No one has time for all that. But if you have a paragraph full of six-word sentences, and then you have the last sentence of that paragraph, that's like a five-line sentence. So what I'm trying to convey in that situation is, now by the time you get finished reading this, you tired. And that's what I'm trying to convey here in this list of things that are horrible, that is really this many and 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 more, period. You tired and out of breath now. So imagine how it is for the people. Because I do, you know, I like things to function on many levels. I think when we're all in the 12th grade, when we're all in the 9th grade, you know, our writing doesn't have to function on many levels. It doesn't. I think it's very good. Like, I read my nephew's work and my niece's work, high school and college. You know, they are both really good writers. They get it from me, obviously. but, you know, they keep it very straightforward. I'm trying to get from word 1 to 800. And when I talk to them about it, you know, they listen, and I know that they are filing it away, and they will probably pull that out in their late 20s or early 30s. But me in my 50s, to be writing sentences that only function on one dimension, I don't think that's doing myself or anybody that reads me a service. I have to give folks the benefit of my experience and expertise. So I go over things, man. I don't, maybe too much is a fault of mine. But I go over things. I'm an editor and a writer. So sometimes I have a five-line sentence, and it's doing the most, and I'll change it back into shorter sentences. And sometimes my editor, I'm blessed, Chris, will say, I saw what you were trying to do there. I saw the intention behind it. I need you to go on ahead and put that back. the way it was. And to me, there's just no higher compliment than that. And I have noticed that in your writing, Javelle. And I think that it's a constant battle for us that choose to write outside the lines to make sure that we're showing people what we can do. And even showing off, being a little peacock about it sometimes. Mm-hmm. Yes, let's give it all that. But also not to make people feel like they don't have a way in.
Right.
Like I don't like to, I didn't have my college degree until I was 37. I got my master's and my BA at the same time after dropping out of UC Berkeley as a sophomore. And I've always been very conscious of the fact that not everybody graduated from Cal. Not everybody has an MFA like I do, or went to the Stanford Knight Fellowship, or all these things that we're blessed to do. I want to write to those folks, my cohort at Stanford. I want peacock a little bit, let you know. But I also know that it's a lot of people out here that's out, you know, everybody ain't able. Mm-hmm. Everybody wasn't able. Everybody didn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I want those people, that's something that Vibe taught me. When we would get those letters in from the editor, listen, those people took Vibe so seriously. Mm-hmm. And they put so much effort into writing down on actual paper with a ballpoint pen how they felt about this, that, and the third. So many people writing in from prison, okay? Mm-hmm. Writing in from just the projects, and writing in from, like, I'm getting my PhD from Yale. Mm. And I just feel like I don't want to alienate those folks that, like, they need to understand me too. And that's why, as smart as I think I can be, I also just try to remind people that I am from East Oakland. Mm-hmm. And if I want to put, pardon my language right now, but if I want to put a motherfucker up in my text,
mm-hmm.
I shall. If I want to count things up like I know people used to count dope, stack money, mm-hmm. and make that into a metaphor. If I want to convey something by saying just like it is when you're standing in line for food stamps, that's as important to me than all my that's as important to me as all my stats and information, as all my sitting in my MFA class learning how to layer metaphors and doing all the things that we learn to do there. So on my best days, I'm managing all that on the page, and it doesn't happen every page. Mm-hmm. But on those pages that it does, listen, we know how that feels.
Period.
As writers, we know how that feels. You be reading it back going, did I do a little something today? Did I put some work in today? Yes. I think I
listen.
Did.
Listen. Yes. There's nothing yes. like that. There's nothing like that feeling of, I might not have done much today, but I did get that done.
I did.
Like that you did that. You did
yes.
that.
And on that note, cocktails, right? Let's drink to that lovely sentence. Let's drink to that.
Exactly. That took me 9 hours to finally sit down and write. Yes.
Yes, yes. Yes.
Danielle, we could talk to you all day, and this book is so, it's so personal, but also like it introduces us to these artists in a way that I think is so unique and special, but also informed and journalistic.
We ain't even talking about the Dixie compassionate. Cups, okay? We ain't talked about the Dixie Cups, okay? Y'all need to read the book. Just read the book, y'all. Read the book.
It's so beautiful, and so we want to just thank you for being here and say to encourage everyone to go out and get the book. And also check out Black Girl Songbook that is on Spotify each week, competing with us, coming out each weekly. But like while you're listening to us, make sure that you go over and subscribe to Black Girl Songbook because it is fantastic. Danielle Smith, we thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Congratulations on this book, and thank you for all the work that you put into it.
Y'all, I love you. Thank you for having me, and I can't wait to read what y'all do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Talk soon.
We'll
bye,
make sure
guys.
To send it to you. Before we go, I know y'all thoroughly enjoyed this conversation with Danielle Smith, and you're like, oh, I just want a little bit more. You can go check out her book, Shine Bright, A Very Personal History of Black Women in Pop. You can check out her podcast, A Black Girl Songbook, which is over on Spotify, as we said. But also, we have another episode that we did with her just last year around this same time. It came out in 2021, March 18th. We were talking about the Grammys. The episode is called Grammy Schwammy with Danielle Smith, and we're talking about award shows and how the Grammys tend to work, and it was a really really, really great conversation. Before we go, I just want to say thanks so much for the possibility, the opportunity to take some time off for a few weeks. I'm really exhausted after this book. Travel's going to be taking some time off as well after two books. So thank y'all for your flexibility and the you know, ability to take some time off, because I definitely need it.
Yep. What he said. All right, y'all. We want you to, if you like what you hear, okay, every single week, share the show with somebody in your life. Let them know that they need to be part of the Fanti fam. And as always, if you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, about last week's show, about any week's show, you can hit us up on the socials at Fanti Podcast or send us an email at fanti@maximumfun.org.
Our music is by Corece at Core.ece. You can get him wherever you get your Slayworthy audio. Our graphics are done by Ashley Nguyen over at Moonhouse Creative. And our show is edited by Will Hagel. Our producer is Laura Swisher. This is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.
I need Zoom recording privileges.
Oh, why now?
Look at us figuring out how to do this with Laura on the on the mend. Doing rocket science and shit.
We figuring it out. Okay, go ahead, Jared.